Chapter 4. Despite its size, there were few people in the Malphite Hall as the junior cleric escorted Marius across the jet-black floor. Those who were there gave the higher, mistrustful glances as he glided along effortlessly. It was nothing personal. They simply didn't enjoy non-believers being in this hallowed place. He passed into Liliala Hall, whose ceaseless storm played out across the ceiling. As he walked beneath the apex, lightning bolts arched between billowing clouds, searing narrow gaps in the vapor to reveal the bland Mars twins. At the far end, an arching door let them into the mayor's suite of chambers. Ethan was waiting in the oval sanctum. It had been restored to its original state, the way the Water Walker had arranged it while he was mayor. Chairs and the desk were carved from mer-oak and polished with natural wax, giving off a faint lavender scent. The three high Diocletian windows on the wall behind the desk provided its occupant a splendid view out across Outer Circle Canal and the western corner of Golden Park, with the lazy green undulations of Low Moat filling the gulf to the crystal wall beyond. "Thank you for coming," the cleric conservator said genially. He was sitting behind the desk, the hood of his white robe pulled forward. Even with the loose folds of fabric concealing the side of his head, the semi-organic modules were visible adhering to his skin. Marius bowed respectfully. "Thank you for seeing me, Conservator." Ethan's hand fluttered in dismissal to the assistant cleric. "I trust you are almost recovered," Marius said as he stood in front of the desk. The air in his wake was tainted by wispy shadows from his shimmering black toga suit.
"Almost,"
Ethan smiled thinly. His hand rose to indicate the nodules. "Only three remain, and my doctors tell me they will be removed before the end of the week. It is amazing how the human body's powers of recuperation can be bolstered by good news." "Good news?" Ethan hesitated, wondering if the representative was trying to taunt him. "A human has passed into the void, with the help of the second dreamer." "In an attempt to negotiate a rejection of your pilgrimage?"
"I doubt any ANA representative will comprehend the most basic tenet of the void. It exists to embrace life, to elevate us to the highest pinnacle our poor spirits can aspire to."
"Indeed," Marius said with a deliberate irony.
Ethan caught the implication and smiled gracefully. "With respect, I hardly consider you comparable to Justine Bernelli. From what I've seen, you remain firmly rooted in the physical aspects of the universe."
"I will accept that in the spirit I believe it was intended."
"Thank you."
Ethan sank back in his chair, eyeing the representative curiously. At the start of his campaign to become conservator, he had been cautious about accepting the man's help. Like every aspirant for high office in history, he had used his aid to make the first exploratory contacts. Phelim had returned animated by the possibilities available. Ethan had agreed to listen. Politically, the assistance Marius provided was subtle and invaluable, allowing Ethan to build alliances within the council and among the clerics of the Orchard Palace, propelling him to a position where he could put himself forward for election with a great deal of confidence. Inclusive with that was the offer of ultra drives for the pilgrimage ships, a gift that would generate a near certain success. All of this had been given freely because their objectives were complementary. And in all that time, Marius had never hinted what his faction's objective actually was. Ethan knew it wouldn't be long now. It would be interesting to see what the price could possibly be. However, hasn't the void itself demonstrated Justine's essential humanity by its response to her thoughts? Marius asked the question as if it was some easily dismissed oddity.
"One small dream," Ethan said, "a fast glimpse of her predicament. She certainly hasn't found the heart, or even a Skylord. As her eagerness to reach that star shows, she is concerned only with the physical."
"Yet she demonstrated the mental abilities available to the Water Walker."
"She hardly has his strength."
"She was only awake for a few days of the Void's timescale, and she appeared to be acclimatizing comfortably."
"This too serves to reinforce our doctrine. The Void will become our salvation. The second dreamer will lead us to our destiny as the dreamer Inigo always intended."
"I think we both know it wasn't the second dreamer who provided this latest glimpse from within the void."
"Yes," Ethan conceded. Does Living Dream know who received Justine's thoughts and vision?
No.
Marius smiled. On his round face with its thin nose, the gesture was unpleasant. Yet another dreamer, conservator. They seemed to be becoming quite commonplace. 3 dreamers in 270 years is hardly commonplace, but I do consider it significant that 2 have appeared so close together at this particular time. Events are coming to a climax, in accordance with the dreamer Inigo's vision.
Of course, I am gladdened that the second dreamer has proved it is physically possible to enter the void. It must be inspirational to your movement.
It is.
And I don't have to emphasize how important the second dreamer is to you. How close are you to acquiring him? Ethan smiled back into that barely human face with its steady green eyes and humorless thoughts.
Her, actually.
Really?
Yes, we believe we have identified a possible candidate. Given that the welcome team on Vyosha now have her identity, it is impossible for her to elude us for any significant time.
Congratulations, Conservator. It must be gratifying having your goals so close to realization.
It is.
How are you progressing with construction of the pilgrimage ships?
Again, we are blessed by good fortune. The construction is on schedule. Would you like me to arrange a tour for you?
Time, alas, is tight, in more ways than one.
What do you mean?
This isn't yet common knowledge, but the Commonwealth Navy sent a river-class warship to intercept the Ockerson Empire fleet. They were supposed to disable the command ship and deliver a warning.
Supposed to?
The Navy ship was destroyed. It would appear the Ockersons are stronger than Admiral Casimir expected.
Sweet lady.
Unless they are stopped, they will be here before your ships are completed. There will be no pilgrimage.
The principal justification behind ANA was to give the Commonwealth an unassailable defense against alien aggression following the Starflyer War. It was supposed to ensure complete technological superiority.
Don't be too upset. It was, after all, just one ship. A stronger Navy force should be sufficient to deter the Ockerson fleet. Even we concur with that prognosis.
But there are no guarantees.
There never are in life.
There are in the void, Ethan said reflectively. Unfortunately, we can't build the ships any faster.
I know. We are all dependent on ANA.
A wing and a prayer.
Quite. On a happier note, now we are so close to success, my sponsors have a request.
Ah,
Ethan widened his smile. He almost relished this. Would it be a preposterous, heretical demand? Or some simple requirement that would trigger a political avalanche in the wake of the pilgrimage's departure? Was he going to welcome the stipulation, or fight it to his dying breath?
We would like to send some observers with you.
Observers? That implies they will remain aloof, which I sincerely doubt is possible within the void.
Nonetheless, we would be grateful if you would take them with you.
We welcome all those who would reach for the void. Whatever their initial reasons. How many?
2 or 3 on each ship. We don't wish to burden you.
I see.
Though in truth Ethan didn't. He knew this must be momentous to whatever faction Marius represented, yet even he was surprised by how eminently reasonable the request was. I will make sure enough suspension chambers are reserved.
They will not be traveling in suspension.
Is there a reason for that?
They don't wish to.
Ethan considered that, wondering if this was where he should make his stand. Of course, there was no reasonable argument he could put forward against it, only instinct.
Will they be antagonistic to our pilgrimage in any way?
Your pardon, but they care nothing for your doctrine. They are merely scientists who wish to study the void.
And if I refuse?
Marius adopted an amused tone.
You are trying to determine how honorable I am, if I will be awkward.
Will you?
More than most, I have facilitated your rise to your current position. The gift of the ultra-drive engines is phenomenally generous, even by higher standards. And when you accepted this, you knew we would ask a small favor in return.
I did. And you know I will allow your colleagues to travel with us. I'm just trying to understand the motivation behind this. How badly you want it.
Very badly indeed. The void is a magnificent scientific enigma. My sponsors believe it should be solved.
Why would you want to solve something you can become a part of at any time?
It is greater than us.
And it will share itself with you.
On its terms. To accept that is not in our nature.
It is in mine.
Shall I move to the threat now?
Please do,
Ethan said smoothly.
Even with Ultra Drive, the Rael present a problem. Clearly this previously unknown warrior caste will not let you approach the void boundary. Allowing a lone human in a small ship to slip past is one thing, but the pilgrimage ships with their millions of hopeful dreamers? You will either turn back or die. The resources they have available are phenomenal. I suspect even a full Commonwealth Navy escort would struggle to protect you, and governance has quite clearly stated it will do no such thing.
It is the last obstacle, Ethan admitted. The one downside to Justine's triumph, and shocking in its magnitude. He'd always known the Rael opposed pilgrimage, but no one had known they had such ships, or the resolution to prevent entry into the void. The Unisphere commentators had been very keen to point this out over the last few hours. Pilgrimage to certain death, the less savory ones had named it. In addition to the Ultra Drive, we can equip your ships with force fields which the Rael cannot penetrate, Marius said.
I find that claim difficult to believe.
Nonetheless, we have such systems available.
Your passengers?
Yes.
The lady moves in mysterious ways. But she would want your scientists granted the opportunity to achieve their destiny along with the rest of us?
Marius cocked his head to one side. I'm sure she would.
I will have the cabins set aside for you.
Thank you. Marius bowed and rotated effortlessly. He moved towards the door.
Just as he reached it, he stopped.
Oh, yes, he said, still not facing Ethan. And we'll need a cargo hold in each ship for the equipment.
Equipment?
They will need instruments to study the void, obviously. I will send details to your office.
The door opened, and Marius slipped through in a swirl of silent shadow.
Balmy sea air gusted across Golden Park, stirring the long branches of the cherry trees that were planted along the side of the giant plaza. A cloudless sky helped magnify the heat. In his cotton shirt and thick denim trousers, the delivery man was getting uncomfortably warm, and he didn't want to use his bionic functions to cool down for fear of attracting attention to himself. Inigo had supposedly chosen this spot to build Macathran II because the climate was almost identical to the original on Querencia. So because of that quest for perfection, he had to make do with a ridiculous wide-brimmed leather ranger hat, because that's what the natives back in the real Macathran apparently used to wear to keep the midsummer sun from frying their brains. At least it left him indistinguishable from the rest of the crowd occupying the plaza. Golden Park was very full every day now. The usual crowd had swollen considerably when the second dreamer rejected the Sky Lord as the faithful had sought guidance from their new cleric conservator. And from that day on, they had flocked here to witness the monumental events elsewhere in the galaxy. The delivery man could appreciate that, feeling the kind of comfort that only ever came from being immersed in a multitude who shared beliefs and emotions. The most basic human need to belong, amplified by the Gaia field. On a very minor level, he was experiencing that himself. The longing to be back home, playing with the girls as night fell across London. Bath time, stories at bedtime, a leisurely meal with Lizzie. He didn't want to be here. It was that simple. This kind of observation was the kind of active operation the faction had assured him he'd never be involved with. All he ever agreed to do for them was deliver essential items of equipment to the people who would use them. Inevitably, as the years progressed, he'd allowed himself to be cajoled into assignments that entailed a great deal more than mere delivery. But this. Once again he was keeping tabs on Marius. He'd done it before without protesting, though Marius always gave him the creeps, which wasn't the kind of emotional nonsense a hire should be infected with.
It was just that his opposite number was a lot more professional at all this than he was. Nor did the unfolding events help his equilibrium. Justine's flight into the void, the destruction of the Yenisei, the Vyosha invasion. He couldn't imagine what the end effect on Commonwealth society would be. He just knew his place was at home, caring for his family in the face of such uncertainty. Instead, here he was wandering about with the crowds, making sure he was oozing the same emotional wonder and trepidation into the Gaia field as everyone else, wearing medieval clothes, generally blending in. He could see the outer circle canal through the throng, with several gondolas sailing along sedately, backdropped by the orchard palace with its roof that resembled merging waves. All the time he kept his eye on the wire and wood bridge which led over to the palace's main entrance. It was the one Marius had walked over not an hour before. Remote sensors secreted around the canal watched the other bridges for him. Infiltrating systems inside the palace itself was difficult. Living Dream employed some extremely sophisticated shielding and counter-intruder systems, though a number of stealthed microbots were currently inching their way inwards. Even if they managed to get past the great halls and into the mayor's suite of chambers, they'd be too late. The delivery man's bionic field scan function detected a familiar bionic signature 10 meters away. He let out a resigned sigh and turned to see Marius standing waiting. He was getting a lot of disapproving stares as his dark toga suit refracted the bright sunlight in abnormal undulations, but his implacable demeanor was enough to keep them away.
"Gotcha," Marius said.
The delivery man nodded.
"Yes. Congratulations. Fancy a drink?" "Why not?"
Marius Glyde walked his way across Golden Park and over the ginger sandstone bridge into Isidro. The delivery man narrowed his eyes as he took in the circular three-story building with an improbable hexagonal rustication pattern on the walls. Tall lancet windows gave the appearance of some ancient human castle tower.
"Isn't this the one where..." he began. "Yes," Marius said.
They went into the tavern and managed to find a quiet table by one of the windows. A waitress took their order and quickly returned with a hot orange chocolate with marshmallows for the delivery man and a peppermint tea for Marius. Once she'd gone, they wove their screening shields together, creating an almost invisible yet secure bubble around the table.
"The game is changing," Marius said.
"The game is the same. The stakes are rising," the delivery man countered.
"Fair enough. I don't like you because you symbolize what we're attempting to leave behind. But I respect you. You play by the rules. There are some people in our line of work who no longer do that. We didn't wreck Hanko."
"Hanko?"
"Please. One of you fired a Hawking M-Sync into it."
"Did we?"
"Yes."
"Are you sure about that?"
"Don't do that. Don't call me in for a drink and play the subversion recruiting routine. I chose my faction because of my beliefs, just like you."
Marius raised his cup in salute. "My apologies. My point is that you and I are both nearing the end of our usefulness to our respective factions.
Now, if we hold things together, you and I will continue in our current form. Only if you get to enact your particular Armageddon does everything alter.
You don't have a clue what we're doing.
Fusion is not a pretty concept. It assumes elevation to perpetual godhood. The conflict here at this table is enough to convince me that should not be allowed to happen. And we both know there are factions a lot more radical than us."
"My apologies again. You have all the answers."
"Of course, you could choose to come over to us. That would undoubtedly mean the end of your faction. Problem solved for everyone."
"I don't think so."
"I had to ask."
"I know."
The delivery man tried to sip his chocolate through the cap of semi-molten marshmallows.
"So now what?"
"As I said, the game is changing.
We are entering the last stages of an operation which has been centuries in the planning. As such, it is no longer a game. Please do not think we will tolerate any interference. The human race, for all our facets and our institutional stupidity, is something I believe in. I admire our diversity, our stubbornness. The dynamic of conflict is one of our greatest traits.
Please don't give me the "we're at our greatest when our backs are against the wall" speech. I can't, because you seem to want to eliminate our conflict, our differences, to rebuild us in your image. I will not allow that to happen. My faction will not permit that. Which is my point. You no longer have that luxury of choice. It was taken from you decades ago when we succeeded. This, today, this is just the result of our actions. You cannot believe that morally you have the right to elevate everyone to post-physical status, whether they want that or not. We won't be taking everyone. Then stop trying to manipulate everyone. You seem determined to remain in the past. Is that your wife's influence? The delivery man placed the chocolate cup on the table. It was all he could do not to shatter the china his grip had tightened so. Be very careful. We have the right to evolve. You do. You do not have the right to evolve the rest of us, nor ruin what we have built in the process. Much good your ANA governance has done you. It is the most conservative faction of all. It made you possible. Exactly. And now, like an enfeebled parent, jealous of our youth and vision, it strives to hold us back. It neither encourages nor refuses your ambitions. It is neutral as always. We, on the other hand, are not. Find a way of doing what you want without harming others, without endangering the entire galaxy. We do neither. You cannot stop us elevating ourselves into something glorious. Do not try. That is what I am saying to you. We have come to the end of this tedious routine, you and I. Next time we meet, it will not be sitting in a tavern over a friendly drink. If that's the way it is, then that's the way it is. The delivery man watched Marius give him a sad little smile, then glide out of the tavern. Only then did he exhale a very shaky breath. Oh, dear Ozzy, he hissed. I can't do this anymore. The storm had been rising steadily for 3 hours now. A continual cloud of miniature ice daggers were hurtling horizontally through the air, smashing into the ground crawler at close to 100 miles an hour. The noise was astonishing, as if they were buffeting their way forwards through a jungle of glass. As before, the land shifted without warning, sending the ground crawler rocking violently. Corilin gripped her seat tighter. It was the 5th mini-quake in the last hour, and they were coming closer together.
I'm sorry, Corilin said. She was sitting beside Inigo as he attempted to steer them across hilly land, locked into shape by the permafrost.
All the loose snow that had accumulated in dunes and crevices was slowly and methodically being swept up by the wind, hardening further as it took to the air to join the atmospheric bedlam. They could see nothing through the narrow windscreen now. Even the powerful headline beams created little more than a dusky glow in the merciless blizzard. The ground crawler's sensors could only scan a derisory 15 to 20 meters ahead. His bionic field scan function merely supplemented the perception.
Nothing to be sorry for, Inigo told her. He reached out and gripped her hand.
Corilin leaned in towards him.
If I hadn't come, none of this would have happened. The restoration team would still be alive. You could have carried on rescuing people.
The universe doesn't work like that. They would have found me, one way or another. I'm glad it was you.
I've killed you.
The tears were running freely down her freckled cheeks. Inigo stopped the ground crawler and put his arms round her.
That's just fright you're feeling. You must not blame anyone, least of all yourself.
How can you be so calm?
All I have seen, all Ediard showed me. It gives me hope. Hope doesn't die just because a life is lost. Not even a million lives. The human race carries on. We have before, many times. We will again.
As stupid as ever, she grumbled, wiping at the tears.
He caught her hand and brought it to his own face, then slowly licked the moisture from her fingers.
That's my Corilin.
She nestled up against him. I still think it's my fault. I should never have let that psychopath talk me into this.
From what you've told me, you didn't have a lot of choice.
I could have been bolder. I could have thrown him off a cliff like you did.
Well, in the end, that hasn't made a lot of difference, has it?
I'd prefer not to spend my last moments with him, thank you.
We're not dead yet.
Inigo let go of her and turned back to the console. Only another 200 kilometers to my starship.
You really have one?
I really have one. Smart man, that Aeron, working that out. The ground crawler lurched forwards again. Corilin came over from her seat to stand behind Inigo and massaged his shoulders.
How far have we come?
About 80 kilometers in the last 17 hours. He nodded at the windscreen. It's getting worse out there. I'm guessing the quakes are the start of the implosion. No wonder the atmosphere is kicking up.
We're not going to make it, are we?
No. She bent down and nipped his ear.
Hey, you're a messiah. You're supposed to inspire your flock.
Would the flock settle for certainty?
I thought there were no absolutes.
I can see you're going to be a difficult convert.
The ground crawler juddered alarmingly as the landscape outside heaved. Corilin's grip tightened as she struggled against being thrown to the metal decking.
Lady!
Inigo grunted. The portal projecting the sensor images showed a crack in the ground running almost parallel to the ground crawler. In some places it was over 2 meters wide. It hadn't been there before the quake. Inigo upped the speed of the tracks, sending them wobbling away from the crack.
Why did you leave us?
Corilin asked.
No great revelation, he said. I was tired. Tired of the expectations. Tired of the council. Tired of the adulation.
And me?
No. Never you. I wouldn't have stayed as long as I did if it hadn't been for you.
I don't believe you.
Inigo laughed. If you're not an absolute, you're definitely a constant. Why don't you believe me?
Because I know you. Or I did back then. You believed in the dreams, in the life the Water Walker showed us, the life we could live in the void. You never tired, not of that, not of being our dreamer. What happened?
Maybe I shouldn't have left. Lady, look what's happened because I did. Ethan as conservator. He was never elevated to council for a reason, you know. Why did the conclave vote for him? What were you thinking of?
Change. She snapped at him. Pilgrimage. The second dreamer made it possible, or at least believable. But that's not relevant. That's today, not 70 years ago. Why, Inigo? Don't you at least owe me that?
There was a dream, he whispered. His mind released a deluge of sadness through his Gaia motes, strong enough to make her shudder in dismay.
The last dream, she gasped.
Is it real? Not in the way rumor had it.
But the Water Walker died. That was his victory. He'd finally lived every life. The Sky Lords guided his soul to Odin's Sea. I was there, she growled. I lived that dream, the dream you gave us. I lay back on the pyre atop the tallest tower in Eri and watched the Sky Lords return to fill the sky above Macathran. I rose with him while the whole city sang their hymn of farewell. I received his final gifting to the world. He went to the heart of the void. It was so beautiful, and I believed it. I believed in you.
Corilin shoved her way along the side of Inigo's chair and knelt down, putting her face inches from his.
That is the dream I recall so few times, because it is so powerful I weep each time at what those of us trapped outside the void never had. That is the dream that counts. That is the reason I am a member of Living Dream, your movement. And it is why I always will be, no matter who is in charge or what ridiculous petty politics affect the clerics. You gave us that. You made us dream.
Inigo stared at the sensor projection of the treacherous ground, refusing to meet her eye. His Gaia motes closed up, shutting off his emotions.
Tell me, she demanded, so frightened she was trembling. Tell me what dream you had.
It's just me, he said. That's all. It was just my reaction. There's nothing to stop the pilgrimage, nothing to prevent the faithful from achieving their perfect lives. It just affected me.
What is it, please, Inigo?
I had one more dream, he said, still watching the display. I saw what happened to Quarentia afterwards, after the Water Walker died. It was the life of one of his descendants living in Macathran.
What did they do? She asked. Did they misuse the gift?
The ground quaked again.
gnome, Inigo said with a faint smile. They used it perfectly.
Corilin grimaced in annoyance as the quake got worse. She clutched at the back of Inigo's seat. Both of them looked at each other as the crawler began to tip over. The sensor display showed the ground lifting and splitting. Inigo loaded a quick sequence into the ground crawler's small smart net. Anchors fired out of the lower fuselage, drilling long spikes deep into the frigid soil. Super-strength cables rewound, the tension tightening the heavy machine's grip on the anchors.
Inigo?
Corilin wailed. He gripped her hand.
We're together,
he promised, and opened his mind to her again. The ground beneath the crawler heaved with a profound roaring. All six anchor spikes came flying back out of the disintegrating soil, crashing into the side of the vehicle with a mighty clang.
Together.
The ground crawler started to roll. Corilin yelled in panic as she was thrown into the side of the cabin. Then the walls carried on moving. Inigo was hanging upside down in his seat as the safety webbing held him in place. Corilin tumbled down towards the back of the cabin as the angle shifted. The ground crawler was skidding along on its roof. Another judder from the ground pushed it up on its nose and twisted. Several storage locker doors popped open, releasing a clutch of clothes and crockery and food packets that pelted through the interior, bounding about dangerously. Corilin lost her hold on the galley section, to be tossed about. She felt her arm break as she hit the external door. The pain was awful, dulling her mind. Even the cabin dipped into gray. She actually thought, this is the end. A couple of miserable breaths later and she was still whimpering where she'd fallen. The ground crawler had stopped moving.
Hang on, Inigo called above the constant clamor of the blizzard. I'm coming.
She watched him through a haze as her stomach grew very queasy. He had to climb up the side of the forward cabin, twisting round the front chairs with a contortionist's agility. Somehow the ground crawler had finished up standing on its nose with the deck inclined. Inigo wound up sitting on the back of the driver's chair, cradling her. She stared up at the bulkhead above with its small storage locker doors swinging open.
My arm,
she cried. The dull pain was rising to heart agony. Her exovision medical displays were flashing up tissue damage summaries. Inigo looked round the cabin.
These crawlers always have medic packs. There'll be one around somewhere. Get your nerves to shut down the pain.
She nodded, which nearly made her squeal. Concentrating on the physiological icons was difficult, but eventually her secondary routines were closing off nerves to her arm. Her ankle was damaged too, though that was minor compared to the arm. She let out a huge sigh as the pain faded. Nothing she could do about the queasiness, however. Inigo left her to rummage through all the junk that was cluttered round them. He found a first aid pack. The case started to analyze the data her macrocellular clusters gave it, and opened up various ply-plastic appendages which wiggled across her shoulder. Inigo cut away her sleeve to give it access to her skin.
Now what?
She asked. He glanced at the portal display, which remained resolutely blank. We're wedged into a fissure, with our arse sticking up into the air.
How's that for dignity?
Can your field functions get us out? Not easily. I suppose I can give it a go, though.
That's good. I was almost worried there.
He chuckled and stroked her face. We'll just wait a minute. I want to be certain you're all right before I leave you.
I don't want you to leave right away, she said shakily.
Then I'll stay. We're not in a hurry.
Not today.
The Alexis Denken was only 90 minutes out from Arevalo when Casimir called.
We just lost our communication link with the Lindau, he said.
Paula, who was sitting at her piano trying to master Furelis yet again, let her shoulders slump.
Oh, crap. I thought you were going to warn them to be careful. I did. Evidently, I wasn't clear enough.
So now Aaron has a navy ship.
A scout ship. And it might be Inigo.
Or the Water Walker himself. Or Nigel's come back. Or maybe...
But she didn't finish that one.
There's no need to be cruel.
We're getting stretched very thin, Casimir.
I know, but there is some good news. The Lindau might not be communicating, but I can still keep track of it.
How?
There's a secondary trans-dimensional channel generated by all Navy ship drives. It's used for one thing only, to supply us with their location for precisely this reason.
I never knew that. So where is it now?
Still on Hanko.
Interesting. If you're Aeron, and you've got yourself a lifeboat, why wait around on a planet that's about to implode?
To find what you originally came for.
Exactly. Keep me updated.
Of course.
Are you going to send another ship?
The Yangtze is already on its way. I doubt it will get there in time.
A river class, no less. You are taking this seriously now. Let us hope it has better luck than the Yenisei.
And the Lindau.
It was raining outside Colwyn City, turbid clouds drizzling the fields and hills with a slick of cold water. A morose day whose lack of wind condemned it to suffer under mist which stifled the land and obscured the upper skies with their pink, cirrostratus clouds. However, inside the force fields, it was dry and sunny as the gloom was diverted round the curving protective barriers. The woman was making the most of the artificial climate, walking in a leisurely way up Dariad Avenue's pronounced slope to window shop. Almost half of the stores along the avenue were open, though most of the bars and restaurants were shut. Supply deliveries were non-existent in Colwyn now that the invaders had shut down all capsule flights. Most people in the city center that morning were heading down the slope towards the river. It was the day the Senate delegation was due to arrive. The residents wanted to give them a welcome they couldn't ignore as their starship touched down at the docks. Already, the crowds were swelling round the sealed-up perimeter. The woman either didn't care or didn't know. She was young and attractive, wearing a fashionable grey-blue dress whose skirt showed off long legs. Men making their way down the slope cast admiring glances and pinged her. She smiled loftily, ignoring the attention. She also somehow managed to ignore the Alezalin paramilitary capsules racing low overhead, their sirens screeching and dousing the pavement with strobing lasers. Ignoring them to a degree that she was unaware of three larger capsules prowling the sky above the avenue's rooftops, unaware as they suddenly stopped their circling to power dive. She was still unaware right up to the moment when their 7G deceleration smacked them down beside her with such force their pressure waves burst the glass window she was looking through. She screamed as she was shoved painfully to her knees amid the glittering shards, her arms folded round her head to try and protect her. The big capsules halted, floating 10 centimeters above the concrete. Their malmetal doors opened fast, and Major Honnelard jumped out, leading his welcome team into a surround and secure formation, putting the woman at the center of a circle produced by the nozzles of 15 high-caliber energy weapons. She was screaming incoherently as they encircled her, blood running from 100 tiny glass nicks, her dress all but shredded.
"Shut the fuck up!"
Major Honnelard bellowed at her. Everyone on the outside of the three capsules who had flung themselves flat lifted their heads to see what in Ozzy's name was going on. They saw an armor-suited figure grab the woman's hair and lift her brutally to her feet, saw the agony on her mutilated face, saw the horrific amount of blood saturating her clothes, dripping liberally onto the pavement. Several of the more astute ones delivered what they were seeing directly to Unisphere news stations.
"Araminta, you are now in the protective custody of the Intermediate Elezalin Forces."
The suited figure pushed her towards the nearest capsule.
"Hey!"
someone on the street protested. One of the welcome team fired a small enhanced explosive projectile over their heads. The detonation forced everyone to cower on the floor again.
"If anyone attempts to interfere with our operation, they will be shot," Major Honnelard announced loudly.
He pushed the bloody, sobbing woman into his capsule, which lifted immediately, its malmetal door still closing as it reached rooftop height. The remainder of the welcome team retreated back into the capsules, covering the prone bystanders in a classic hostile withdrawal protocol. Sitting drinking their morning tea on the balcony of the cafe opposite the drama, Oscar and his team watched the last capsule lift hurriedly into the city's artificially clear sky.
"Good deployment,"
Becky said with grudging admiration. She was wearing a silver-edged beret in the local style, helping to make her look even more beguiling.
"As subtle as a kick in the balls," Timancio retorted dismissively. "Look at them."
He waved a hand towards the stunned citizens who were slowly picking themselves up. There was a lot of anger on their faces. Oscar watched several of them shaking their fists at the sky, shouting obscenities. He was glad he was back wearing civilian clothes. It wasn't going to be pleasant for any of the Alezzelin troops caught alone after today.
"I think Major Honolar is getting somewhat aggrieved," Bekia said.
"What's that? The fifth Araminta the recognition programs have found for him this morning?"
"Leatris is doing well," Timancio said.
"I doubt the latest victim thinks that," Oscar said.
He couldn't drink his cinnamon-flavored espresso now. The callousness he just witnessed was triggering a lot of guilt. The poor woman was perfectly innocent, her only crime to have roughly the same dimensions and features as the real Araminta. That way the whole incident could be blamed on the recognition software that had plucked her image from one of the streetwatch sensors along Dariad Avenue, alerting the welcome team to her location.
"This is your operation, Oscar," Timancio rebuked. "You knew what would have to be done. Don't go soft on us now."
"Of all the people in the galaxy, I am the one who really understands the concept of collateral damage best of all," Oscar announced.
"So you are. Then you know she was a necessary casualty."
"That doesn't make it right."
"Oscar, Alezzelin invading Vyosha isn't right. Hunting Araminta isn't right. But we're all doing it because we all know she has to be found."
"What was her name?" Oscar asked, staring down on the broad avenue.
More people were heading down the slope now, marching to the docks to make their demands heard by the Senate delegation. It was all futile, he knew. Living Dream didn't care for their opinion, nor that of the Senate. The delegation and talks with Phelim and the Prime Minister were just buying the welcome team more time to find their target.
"Does it matter?" Bekia said.
"Yes, actually it does," Oscar said. "We used her."
"I'll have Leatris check it out when he has a moment," Timancio said.
"Thank you."
Timancio and Bekia finished their drinks. Oscar still couldn't bring himself to touch what was left of his. People were getting hurt, and he was the cause. He knew it was stupid, but he really hadn't considered that aspect of the operation when he agreed to help Paula. Dushiku's Unisphere interface code hung in his exovision, so very tempting. Talking things through with his calm, rational partner would make things feel so much better. It was also a sign of weakness, which the Knight's Guardian wouldn't take too kindly. So he sighed when Timancio and Becky arose from the table and gave him an inquiring glance.
"Coming," he said.
They took a public cab from outside the cafe. It rode quickly and smoothly along the metro track that ran down the middle of Dariad Avenue, taking them up the slope into the grid of taller, modern buildings. 10 minutes later it dropped them off in the Palliser precinct, where they walked into a bar that was several social levels below the cafe they'd just left. It was wedged in between a trike repair garage and a wholesale packaging store. A cheap framework of composite, which was supposed to have air coral grown over it, only someone had messed up the pruning hormones, leaving one corner and half the roof misshapen with lumps and cracks. Plastic sheeting had been epoxied over most of the splits decades ago, sealing it against the elements. But they didn't look good. A lot of the patches were peeling away. The current owner had pushed them back and held them down with thick black tape. Sallow fungal weeds were growing out of the pox on the roof, parasiting the air coral's paltry nutrients. Oscar glanced down to the far end of the street where Colwyn City's big Confluence Nest building stood at the intersection, squat and aloof, looking fortress-like compared to the shabbiness of the structures around it. Inside, the bar was little better, with the windows obscured by ancient hologram adverts and fading overhead lighting strips adding little to the illumination. Tables were scattered about on the ancient wood floor, interspaced with pool tables and tri-gamer stations. Only the counter had decent lighting, with suspended white globes projecting a monochrome glow across the beer pumps. There were less than 10 customers in total. 2 hardcore barflies up on stools lining up shot glasses and aerosols, 1 loner sitting at a tri-game feeding it with his cash coin, and the others huddled round tables. They all ignored the newcomers. Timancio gave the bartender an order for 4 beers, and they claimed a corner table. A service bot trundled over with their glasses.
2 minutes later, Cheriton sauntered in. He did draw some glances, with a big grey coat buttoned up tight so he didn't show off his native Alezzelin clothes. Nothing he could do to disguise the hat, though, which he held in one hand. "So?" Timoncio asked as Cheriton sat down. The Gaiafield expert raised his glass as they used their bionics to establish a screening field. Paranoia reigned supreme. They've got the building net scanning and logging all calls. If I'd encrypted anything I sensed, they would have dropped a cage over me.
Are they suspicious?
Not of us, but they know someone is messing with the welcome team search. We're not the only covert team here.
Leatrice has spotted at least two other infiltrations, Beccia said.
Well, between us, we're certainly stirring up a yarn snapper nest of distrust. The third dreamer hasn't helped.
I would have thought they'd enjoy that, Timoncio said. A near real-time connection into the void that shows we can get inside, and we have psychic powers when we do get there.
Living Dream certainly welcomes that, but it does raise questions about why our dear cleric conservator hasn't been chosen for any communing, nor the rest of the cleric council for that matter.
Are they chasing after the third dreamer now as well? Oscar asked.
No, best guess is that it's someone with a strong natural connection to Justine.
What do you mean, natural connection?
It was always assumed Inigo was related to Ediard somehow, some distant family connection. As we don't know which colony ship wound up inside the void, the link could never be proven, so Living Dream is assuming the same for Justine.
There can't be many left, Oscar said thoughtfully. She's been inside ANA for centuries. All her contemporaries are in there too. That or they're real dead.
Apart from Admiral Casimir, Cheriton said.
No.
Probably not, Cheriton admitted. But we'll never be able to trace it anyway. Justine's dream emanated from the central world's Gaia field, where the confluence nests are all built and maintained by Hires. Living Dream can't touch them.
Thank Ozzy for that, Beccia said. Hang on, Oscar said. Araminta can hardly have a family connection to a Starflyer.
Cheriton grinned. It's not exactly a perfect theory. So Living Dream's emphasis is still on the second dreamer? Timoncio asked.
Very much so.
Cheriton took another drink of the beer. You need to get Leatrice into my building's net and subvert their monitors to establish a secure channel for me. If he doesn't, I'll have to go aggressive to get out, if I send you a warning again.
I'll tell him. What progress are you making with Denal and Mareble? Oscar asked.
Some, though I'm not sure it's going to help much. Denal was given a memory read.
Everyone round the table winced.
Yeah, Cheriton said. As were all the others they rounded up at the apartment raid. I took Mareble down to their headquarters in the docks. She got to see him, but he's still in custody, and she had a restriction order placed on her. As far as Major Honnelar is now concerned, just knowing Araminta is a crime.
So they're no use, then?
I wouldn't say that exactly. Beccia gave Cheriton a knowing glance.
You didn't.
What could I do? The whole Merry Widow syndrome really kicked into overdrive for a while there. She was very upset when I got her back to her hotel room.
Dear Ozzy, Oscar chuckled into his beer.
It establishes me as a genuine supportive friend, Cheriton said, a shade too defensively. That could be useful. A lot of followers are having their faith shaken by the way Phelim is acting. This wasn't what they signed up for.
Okay. Good work, Timoncio said.
Cheriton put his beer back on the table. Have you got any idea where Araminta might be?
Not one.
Leatrice is running 100 analysis routines, trying to figure out where she could have taken refuge. Honnelar won't be far behind him. Even he is eventually going to work out he's being deliberately distracted.
Great. Then the paranoia will really kick in.
They'll go for her family next, Oscar said miserably. Make a big splash of arresting them to flush her out.
Do you want to warn them? Timoncio asked.
If they believe us, and it's a big if, they might make it harder for Honnelar to round them up. Worst case scenario, it'll take him an extra half hour.
You keep telling me every minute is precious. Sounds like a plan. I'll start calling them.
I'd better get back, Cheriton said. He stood up and slipped through the privacy screen.
Nothing from the monitors we've got on Cressida, Beccia said as they waited for Tamancio to complete his anonymous calls to Araminta's family.
We'll go to Nyx next, see if any of her old colleagues can give us a hint where she might be.
Sure, he said. His U-Shadow told him Paula was calling on a secure channel.
Any progress? She asked.
The second dreamer is Araminta, a Vyosha native. So far she's managed to give everyone the slip. We're chasing up what leads we've got, but we're not the only ones here.
You're sure it's Araminta?
Oh, yes.
Oscar smiled fondly as he recalled their second visit to the apartments. He'd actually laughed out loud when he saw the top of the water tank lying on the bathroom floor. And from what they could determine, she'd stopped for a cup of tea and some biscuits before scooting out of there. That was real class. Or total insanity. Either way, he was rather looking forward to the time when he finally got to meet her.
Living Dream knows it too.
Can you get to her first?
We'll do our best.
I have something to tell you, Paula said.
This doesn't sound good.
There is a faction agent in a very powerful starship, equivalent to yours. They just fired a black hole weapon into Hanko. The planet is currently imploding.
Oscar's skin turned chilly. He stared at the bar's colorful hologram adverts without seeing them.
Hanko.
Yes. I'm sorry, Oscar.
But I captained the Dublin there during the Prime attack, he protested weakly. We went through hell protecting Hanko.
I know. This is a new and very dangerous type of weapon. No one expected it to be used like this. I'm telling you so you understand the factions are becoming desperate. Be very careful acquiring this Araminta. It is not a game.
I understand. Why was Hanko so important to them?
Inigo may have been on it.
Wow. I see. Did he escape?
We don't know. There's no communication link to the planet anymore.
Shit.
Oscar, there's something else. I'm telling you in case I vanish. I suspect there's a good chance the agent was the cat.
Oh, no. No, no, no. Not her. She's in suspension. You put her there, for fuck's sake. That was the one thing I made very sure of after they re-lifed me.
I don't know for certain yet. And it'll only be a clone if it is her.
Only a clone? Ah, Jesus. Where is she?
I don't know, but if she turns up on Vyosha, your Knight's Guardian might be tempted to jump ship.
Oh, fuck!
He said that out loud. Very loud. Beccia and Tamancio gave him a curious glance.
Now you know, Paula said. You can take precautions.
Precautions? Against the cat, in an ultra-drive ship with a super-weapon. What kind of deranged moron let her have these things in the first place?
As I said, the factions are getting desperate.
Wait. Why would you vanish?
She, or someone like her, tried to kill me. She'll probably try again. You know what she's like.
I want to go home.
And you will. Not long now.
Damn, I hate you.
Hate is good. It helps keep you focused.
It's not good, he protested irritably. It makes you irrational.
Which makes you unpredictable, which gives your enemies a difficult time determining your actions. It will be harder for her to set a trap for you.
I didn't have any goddamn enemies before you dragged me into this.
If you genuinely need backup, I will come to Vyosha. I simply prefer not to, unless there is no alternative. Do you want me there?
Oscar took a long breath and glared up at the ceiling.
No. I have everything perfectly under control.
He told his U-Shadow to end the call.
Everything all right? Tamancio asked. Blissfully wonderful. Come on. Let's get over to Nyx. While Vyosha's still here.